or the idea, it's superabounded, meaning that God has more grace than we have sin. That's good news, isn't it? Because I don't know about you, but I still deal with a sin issue in my life, and I'm sure you do as well. Well, we've been going along and kind of getting the jump start into the life of Joseph, and we've taken a couple weeks to sidestep here and just minister and what I felt the body needed, and we had a week where we were emphasizing church planting, so we've been 3 weeks away from this, and now getting back. Beginning in chapter 30 is where we have our first mention of Joseph when he is born, but in chapter 37 the book changes to focusing somewhat on the life of Joseph, and we're going to soon get back to that. But in chapter 38, the Bible almost, I'm going to word it this way, it takes a strange turn. All of a sudden it mentions Judah and his family, and really almost some uncomfortable things to talk about in the life of Judah and his family there. Things that we may not feel comfortable discussing in a mixed group, so to speak, with some of the wording there, some of the things taking place. So let me ask you a question. Who can give me just a general idea of what is some of the things happening in chapter 38? Do you remember that chapter? Do you remember what's taking place? Maybe you have a Bible that gives you a heading at the top, or maybe even divides the chapter a little bit and says, now we're talking about this and now we're going to this subject. What happens in Genesis chapter 38? You say, yeah, awkward to talk about, and then you ask us what happened. Sure, that's the plan. That's why I'm in charge. Karin, just kidding. Yeah, yeah. Tamar gets married into the family, but then according to the custom, we'll talk about that a little bit later, Judah doesn't take care of her the way that he is supposed to ultimately, and there's a reason for that. We'll discuss that why in a little bit. And so she turns around and tricks him. How does she trick him? Does anybody remember? What did she play? What did she portray? She made herself out to be a harlot. She made herself out to be a harlot. And so this is the second mention of being a harlot. That can mean a number of things in the Bible, but generally it means someone who's going to commit adultery or fornication. Not necessarily because they are married, but going after those who may be married or those who may be unmarried. And so she dresses in the attire of a harlot. She would veil herself that she would not be discovered who she is. By the way, it was a sin in many of those nations to actually commit adultery, and even a sin that was punished by death. But to be a harlot was not punished by death. That almost sounds interesting and almost odd, but that was not punishable by death unless they were actually trying to seek after those who were married, and then getting caught in that act would lead to the death, actually, of being a harlot. Someone else. What else takes place? Brother Horst. Yeah, what is typical dress that might be known on the street corner, it can be known throughout our country. He's right, but generally they would be identified by the clothing that they wore. And that was definitely true. And part of it being veiled in their day and age, there's a lot of customs that kind of come out of this chapter that we can discuss. Anyone else? What else happens in this chapter? What is a custom that is taking place here? You don't have to know all the details of it, but Tamar is involved in this as well. Wendy? Yeah. This was not a custom necessarily in Israel. I'll voice louder what she said. This was not a custom that started in Israel, but it was happening in the nation of Israel as well. This was a custom really of the land of the Middle East, that if your husband died, then the next younger brother who was not married is next in line and was expected to marry you. So I guess you kind of were taking some interest in who, oh no, don't marry her, and thinking, well, if she ever dies, I'm stuck with her. And so this was the custom of the land, that if you would pass away, your next younger brother who is not married would then be required to marry her and have children by her. And sort of, and if he would die, then the next brother in line, and this is going to come out in this story. In fact, let's look at that briefly here. We're going to look at verse number 2. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And so all of a sudden now, notice, Judah is where? Who's he going toward? What nation? Going toward the Canaanites, and the children of Israel would be warned about this. So we see Judah going in a wrong direction. In verse number 3, we read that she conceived and bare a son. His name was Ur. She conceived again and bare another son to Judah, and his name was Onan. And she conceived again, and Shua began, you know, was the wife now of Judah, and going to bear another son, and his name was Shelah. Well, the Lord was not pleased with this activity in verse number 6, and Judah took a wife for his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And again, she was a Canaanite. And Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. So the judgment of the Lord came upon him, and Judah said unto Onan, and basically unto, Onan, go and marry her, and raise up a seed that would be in the name of your brother. Well, it ends up he does wickedly, and the Lord slowly kills him, but Shelah is still too young. And so what does Judah say now to Tamar? Does anybody know what happens now? Anybody know? Wendy? Yeah. I actually met a guy yesterday who has two children. One's 27 and one's 7 months old. Wow, that's an age gap. Well, I don't think the age gap is so huge here, but realize we have just gone through probably 20 plus years in these 4 or 5 verses. And you have them getting married, having a son old enough to marry, dying, having another son marry, and now another son who's too young to be married, and waiting for him to get old enough. Now, what happens, though? What happens from here? And this is a little bit what Carmen was referring to earlier. What happens as Shelah gets old enough? He does a man thing. He doesn't follow through with what he said, right? Sometimes guys don't do what we say we're supposed to do and gonna do, and we get ourselves in trouble that way. And we're not always the best leaders, even though God has chosen us to lead our homes. God has chosen Judah to lead his home, and he's failing. But let's talk about emotions a little bit. Why do you think he didn't marry them off? Anybody, did you ever stop and think about that? Why doesn't Judah marry Shelah off to Tamar? Now, by the way, we don't have scripture on this, so we're not being dogmatic. But if you, what might hold you back? Wendy. Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing that Wendy just said. Hey, I've had two sons married to her. They both died. I've got one son left. Maybe Tamar isn't the nicest lady in the world, okay? I don't know. The Bible doesn't talk about that aspect of her. Maybe there's an issue there, but thinking, wow, I don't want him to marry her because He may end up dying. He may do wickedly as his brothers did, displease the Lord, and therefore his life be gone as well. And so what Judah does is when he's supposed to marry him off to Tamar, he told her to wait. So in a sense he lied because he didn't follow through with what he said. That is when she will then deceive him by playing the harlot. The story becomes kind of interesting there. He doesn't have right there anything to pay her. And so he's going to end up giving her some of his own possessions. Gives a ring, I think, garments, and what else was it? Bracelets, staff, okay. And so gives some of his possessions to be kind of a down payment, kind of a security deposit, so to speak. Doesn't that kind of sound weird? Here you are with a harlot and you're giving a security deposit to make sure you're going to give her the animals and so forth that you vowed that you would give. Again, Judah doesn't follow through with what he says he was going to do. And all of a sudden he's confronted, hey, there's this harlot with things, and whose are they? And Judah says, boy, that man ought to be judged. By the way, he sounds a lot like David. When he doesn't realize it's him he's talking about, judgment shall come. Aren't we that way sometimes? In fact, I've read this. I don't know that if this is exactly true, but this has been written in books. That we are hardest on people who commit the same sins we do. And we can see them as being exceedingly sinful and ourselves as not that bad. Now, there's been a lot of studies. Now, I don't know that that's true of Christians, but there have been studies on that over the years that people are more judgmental of people committing the same sin as they are when you would think they'd be more judgmental of people committing sins they don't commit. Anyway, that's just out there by interest. And so Judah, you know, speaks out, and then he recognizes he's the guilty one. Isn't that? Aren't they your bracelets? Isn't that your staff? Aren't they your items? And he recognizes that he was deceived. And by the way, deceivers are deceived. Now, let me just stop and ask you this. Why is this in here? Why do we break? Because it's like, have you ever been at a play or something and you have Act 1 and it's here? And it's about this individual and what's going on in their life, and all of a sudden Act 2 is about something else going on simultaneously, or just after that over here, other characters, other location. And then it goes back, Act 3 is back over to this individual and what's going on in that life. And that's exactly what happens here. It's Joseph, and then over to this story with Judah and Tamar, and then back to Joseph again. So why are we over here? Why are we over here talking about Judah and Tamar and all this sin? And strange things to talk about. Why are we here? Anyone? Seth?
The Bible's never been, God was never afraid to air the sin of people that call themselves followers of him. And Judah is, of course, in the line of Christ.
Okay.
Christ is in the line of Judah. So it's, I think that could be one reason why it's here, at least.
Okay. God has never shied away where the followers or his people have committed sin, and unveiling that and using that as a lesson so that we can learn, the Bible says, from their example. He also mentions Judah is the line of Christ, lion of the tribe of Judah. This is the family Christ came from. Well, let me ask you, if this was your family heritage, would you be wanting to discuss it? Maybe that'd be the uncle or the grandpa you didn't mention that you have. Anyone else? An interjection. There's some interesting thoughts going on here, and I've never discussed or even written about. But the question comes, why do we break a wonderful story in seeing God's provisional plan for the nation of Israel through Joseph to interrupt it with a where sin abounds, and this is the title of my Sunday school lesson, where sin abounds, how grace much more abounds, grace super abounds. Again, what's something else maybe you're thinking of here, Carmen? A very, very good comment. Very good observation. You got here a chapter where Judah falls into the temptation and really lunges into it. And the very next, you're going to find Joseph who flees that temptation. And so that's interesting. The Bible gives us both sides of that coin, as she would say. Someone else. Yes, Mrs. Lockhart. Yeah, now the plot thickens, so to speak. Also in the line of Christ is one of the twins that come out of Tamar. And so Tamar has this relationship, a sinful relationship. Twins are going to be born out of it. And one of the twins ends up in the line of Christ. Wow. That makes you think. What else? Anything else? Lynn?
Jim Barnett mentioned it kind of shows the reason why, how the children of Israel basically get involved in the world and how he needed to separate them and move them to Egypt where they were kind of by themselves in the valley. But just how they needed to be separated.
Yeah, no wonder God separated. She's making mention of a teaching that she received by Dr. Berg and how God would then separate his nation from these other nations. And the importance of our separation from the world should be seen here in keeping our children separated from the world, because how quickly things can digress. And all of a sudden here, we see a nation somewhat plummeting and becoming very worldly very quickly because of a few poor choices by Judah and by other family members as well. By the way, when you get into this book of Ruth, you would read a similar story, and again, going off to Moab. And now all of a sudden, Naomi loses her husband and loses both of her sons, and she's now in a Moabite country, and her natural family is not around her. Someone else, what other observation or what other consideration do you make here? Anyone? Yes, Helen. Yeah, that's part of the beauty that really springs out of this, and where the grace, I think, will begin to come in the second part of this lesson. How that you think, wow, the line of Christ, it must be majestic, must be beautiful, must be angelic, must be no chinks in the armor, so to speak. And it's filled with sinful people making sinful choices. And it's even had children born out of adulterous relationships and sinful relationships. 'Cause remember, Judah's married when all this transpires. And so think of the plummeting of this nation of Israel, of Virginia.
Judah has acknowledged his sin as being that she was in a righteous.
Yeah. Through this, he sees himself as exceedingly sinful. And while he at one point saw her as wicked, now he sees her as more righteous than he is. And sometimes God knows how to humble us, does he not? And to make us see, others aren't as bad as we are. I guess we would say it that way. And I think that's a great observation that Virginia sees there. Yeah, she's been more righteous than me. And he recognizes his sinfulness there. Someone else. Right?
I think some of it too, Joseph could have used a lot of this as an excuse. You know, the Bible mentions the sins of Jacob, and then obviously his brothers were very wicked, but Joseph, a lot of times people want to blame the environment they come out of for their actions, and the Bible talks about all these sins of his brothers and his father, but Joseph still is faithful and serving the Lord in spite of.
Well, good, excellent observation. Yeah, Joseph could have used the excuse, this is what our family's like. This is how we are. And by the way, sometimes we use excuses like that. And, I grew up and I've become like my parents. I've become like my brothers, my siblings. And the proof is, no, a godly person can be raised out of a dysfunctional, ungodly home. And I hate to say it, but we're talking about the line of Christ. And right now it's an ungodly home. And it's an ungodly line. But it doesn't give us an excuse. And it doesn't mean that we can go and ought to just follow the stream. No. We ought to rise up and to honor and glorify the Lord as Joseph did. And so again, it gives hope. I see a number of things gives hope, just because there's sin in our lives doesn't mean God can't use us. And that was brought out by Helen. And just because there's sin in our lives doesn't mean we can't rise up above that, as Brian just brought out, and show ourselves as servants of the Lord. Okay, let's go to Seth. And I want to go to Romans for a second. I think you have the verse. So don't worry about turning there, but. Yeah, he chose this to be his line. Good. That's a sovereign God chose this. Remember, he came unto his own because he knew his own needed it. His own were exceedingly sinful. By the way, did I put Romans 5:20 in your notes? I did. Look at the first part of the verse. The law entered. Okay. And so God knew these people were, in a sense, lawless, that the offense might abound. Wow, now there's a lot of theology here, and I don't want to chase that rabbit, as they say, and again, spend some weeks in this. This is heading in a timely fashion to a proper end, so I don't want to run that. But the idea is here, man, the law was needed. But even more than the law, grace was needed. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. Now, we've already begun to focus our eyes. We've talked about sin long enough. Let's talk about grace. Now, we've already started talking about grace. And one is the fact that God would choose to use this family. This is the grace of God. And that God would be willing to allow this kind of activity within the heritage or the lineage of his son. Where else do you see grace in this? How do you see the grace of God coming out of chapter 38? And some of this is going to be mentioned in the Gospels, where my mind is going, and you can even look at some of the notes on your page and might get some ideas from it. Where do you see God's grace? Brother John.
I see it. The two sons get killed with no offspring. But Tamar, even though she was sinful, found, or God gave her the grace to be one of the ancestors of Jesus Christ.
Yes, she doesn't deserve that. When we talk about grace as an undeserved favor, she didn't deserve this. Here's a Gentile woman being able to be brought into the line of Christ through committing an adulterous relationship. Break it down. Take it to where it is. And I would generally say that as we have read through this chapter, we've just moved on in our reading and never really taken the time to stop and just consider everything happening here. But this is undeserved favor. God actually allows a Gentile woman to be brought into the line of Christ through an adulterous relationship when she deceives someone. That's grace. By the way, no greater grace than I've received. That's a measure of grace I've never needed. I've needed grace beyond that. Else. Anyone else? Mr. Berman.
What is the last phrase of verse 24?
Okay, let's go to verse number 24. And I've actually turned away here, so let me get to there. Genesis. Maybe Pastor Terry can answer that while I'm looking for it. Chapter 38, verse 24. Where it says, discern, I pray thee, whose are these, the signet, is that what you're talking? Oh, no, I'm in 25, sorry. Let me read through the verse. I think I've already studied this out. And it came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, the daughter, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot also. Behold, she is with child by whoredom. That's an interesting statement there. That word whoredom there is identifying the fact that she was being an harlot. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. Well, at this point, the idea is, because the fact that the relationship has been identified as an adulterous relationship, he is saying that she is guilty of being killed. And bring her forth that she might be judged. So again, here's when he's seeing her as wicked and he's seeing himself as righteous. And he said, judge her. She deserves to be judged. By the way, because of his sin, he actually deserved to be judged in that same way. But doesn't mention that. And that's why he will turn and later on say, she's been more righteous than me. So what he's doing is swinging the gavel, so to speak, and casting judgment upon her. And she should be killed for this. And then would later on recognize his own guilt and the fact that she was being more righteous. She was really making a statement by what she was doing. Okay? Anyone else? Now, what's interesting is when we get to the genealogies, genealogy is the family tree of Christ. They're mentioned in what two books in the New Testament? Do you know? Matthew, and it's going to be in Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1 because it is the speaking to the Jews. So he's going to bring that out because he's speaking to the Jews. What line is traced? Whose line is traced in the book of Matthew? Is it Mary or Joseph's? Joseph, the line of Joseph. Who's the other one? Luke. What chapter? Don't worry, I couldn't remember either. Chapter 3. And it's through the line of Mary. Now remember, Luke is writing to the, do you remember? Gentiles. Okay. Interesting to me If you heard, Luke was writing to the Gentiles. Luke's a historian. And Matthew's writing to the Jews. Who would you think would include the women? I think Luke. Oh, a couple reasons. I think Luke because, by the way, I'm wrong in my thinking. If that would be my guess, I'm wrong. But Luke pays more attention in his history to the activity of the women than any of the other gospel writers. So Luke has already leaned toward writing about the ladies involved in the life of Christ, but he doesn't write about them in the genealogy. Luke is also including, he's writing the Gentiles, and guess what? These ladies are Gentiles. And he doesn't include them. So it's really interesting to me. This makes the dynamic of the line of Christ so much more interesting when it comes from Matthew who's writing to Jews, and Matthew's interjecting, but remember these Gentiles are in his line too. So who are the women mentioned? It's on your sheet there. But that's not going to do you any good. Look down and cheat like that. But who are the women mentioned? It starts with Tamar. Who's next? Rahab the... Wow. Tamar the harlot. Rahab the harlot. By the way, so far, Gentile. Who's next? Ruth. Which is interesting. Because Ruth is a... She's not a harlot, but she is a Gentile. So we've got now three different nations, and we've got these women that are coming out of these nations, and then we have, what's the next one? Bathsheba. Wow, listen to what Matthew writes. And Jesse begat David the king, and David the king begat Solomon with her that had been wife to Urias. Wow. Isn't that an interesting way to word the genealogy of Christ? Basically saying, her that was stolen away from her husband. It mentions Urias here. Wow, God honors, in a sense, Urias. But because he was more noble than David, just like Tamar was more righteous than Judah, God mentions Urias here. He's the husband of Bathsheba that was killed, and that comes out in the genealogy. But again, this all points to the grace of God. And it just shocks me that this is out of Matthew's writing to Jews. And that must stun a Jewish person reading this. Maybe even upset them. That God would include in the lineage of His Son, the Messiah, these Gentile women, and some of them harlots, known for their harlotry. Grace much more abounds. Any comments to that? Any comments, questions? Just the idea of God now using these ladies. Which, this is one thing I failed to do. I thought of it and I've completely failed to do. Mary is also mentioned, of course. But I don't know the genealogy of Mary as far as was she known to be more Gentile than Jew. I'm thinking she's full in the line of Jewish roots now. But, you know, there's a little bit of Gentile in her, actually, which is kind of interesting, that one that is highly favored of the Lord. Any comments or questions to this? The grace of God seen in Genesis 38. Wendy?
And you know, begins a relationship there, but then the next verse he gets married, and then he has this relationship with him. So it's almost like maybe it's in there because he thought, oh, well, you know, I'm going to spare Joseph's life by not killing him, but then he thought maybe that would save his dad, but it didn't even save his dad.
Yeah.
So then
maybe disheartened by the fact, yeah, she brings up a good point. He's the one wanting to spare the life of his brother. And maybe disheartened that that didn't bring his father into great favor with him, nor his brothers. So maybe there's some turmoil in the home. Maybe he's very upset at his brothers and the direction things took. And again, we're just kind of reading between the lines a little bit, Brother Butch. Yeah, and you think of that now, that story, when Christ knew within his own line was an adulteress, several of them. And so adulteress and adulterers. And so, yeah, that brings up very interesting in how God was so merciful. By the way, do you have any scars in your life? Anything that you really want to hide from others? Number one, you can't hide it from God. Number two, you don't need to, because He has more grace than you have scars. See, you look back in parts of your life and so embarrassed and so ashamed and thinking you can't move forward and God can't ever use you. I want you to know God can use you. I had in my Bible to take us to two other passages yet, and I'm just going to mention them and not go there next week even. We're just going to move forward. But in Isaiah 61, where he talks about it'll give you beauty for ashes. Boy, what an exchange program that God has. He says he'll take away your sins and give you the righteousness of Christ. And then over in Isaiah 55, where he says, you know what, your thoughts aren't his thoughts, neither are your ways his ways. And what does that ultimately get to? The point of talking about how forgiving he is. Because so often we are not. But to realize this, dear friend, no matter what is in your life, no matter what is in your past, to recognize that God can still use you in a very wonderful way. The reality of how God not only allowed these women to be part of the line, He could have hidden that from us. He didn't have to mention that again in the New Testament. He didn't have to have Matthew write about that to Jews. He could have just discussed the line and could have skipped over, very righteously, could have skipped over mentioning Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba. He could have skipped over all those stories that would kind of put a blot, a stain on his lineage. But no, God chose to include it. Do you know God isn't embarrassed about you? God isn't ashamed. God wants to use you for His honor and glory. And this chapter that we generally just kind of read and move forward really has a lot of impact and shows us a lot of sin, but shows us more grace, the grace that we need. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for your